On this Missouri Review podcast, we present the first place and first runner-up entries in the voice-only literature creative nonfiction category of our 2007 audio competition. First place went to Albert Haley's The Cough, and the first runner-up was Lisa K. Buchanan's All That I Missed, which also won an Editor's Choice Award. We begin with The Cough by Albert Haley. Haley is an associate professor of English at Abilene Christian College. He authored Exotic, the winner of the John Irving First Novel Prize. Haley's short fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, Rolling Stone, and Image, a journal of the arts and religion. His poetry has been published in Poems and Plays, The Texas Review, Christianity and Literature, and Rattle.
The Cough. Tonight, I am still awake, headphones crowning my head. These weighty acoustic bras that cup my ears keep me from disturbing my sleeping wife and child down the hall as I tap into my musical Ambien. Flop back into a chair, I listen to a CD of Svetislav Richter playing Beethoven's Sonata No. 23, the Appassionata. It's simple, supposed to be anyway, this living and being and seeking love and art and wisdom and then sleeping, and more living and being and seeking love, art, wisdom, and blessedly sleeping. Simple, except it's not. Beethoven understood. Tonight in a bed 400 miles away, my 82-year-old father is having his own oblivion. On his side, curled up, he's breathing at least. And now the music for insomniacs is starting. The liner notes state that Richter's Appassionata was recorded 4 days before Christmas 1959 at a concert in Moscow. I see people walking in from icy streets, a girl checking the men's coats, the women's not-too-bourgeois furs. The concertgoers are stolid Marxist-Leninists. They have come to soak up old European music in the midst of a frozen land covered in white, whose future looks entirely red. At this point, my father is a near-total wreck. A World War II vet who once survived a mortar round that landed at his feet somewhere in France, he is now a widower. He's become a shuffling shambles of a man. His once mighty executive accomplishments for a major oil company far behind him. He hunkers down in the foxhole of his empty house. Still he breathes. Except he has a cold on this day, which at his age can always lead to something else. He coughs in his sleep, but I'm not worried, not yet. There are coughs, and then there are coughs. And Richter, I'm still trying to fall into a somnambulant mood, listening to him, this post-war luminescent invention, winding himself tighter, only to lightning bolt ahead. Surely such energy will beat drowsiness into me. This genius artist who owns Beethoven from the first notes until... Richter plays on, but I'm casting about for the remote. Seconds later, I work the laser beam back. There, a terrible hack from the audience that occurs in the midst of the andante con moto. Suddenly, I'm thinking about my piano teacher from decades ago and 7 years of lessons in her home in the trailer park. Old Mrs. Hyacinth had standards. You did not progress in a piece until you had mastered the first major and then the next. You stayed with it until the mountain was completely mined. And you can always begin by playing your scales, child, those marvels of up and down tedium that should have been so easy, but in reality were potholed roads for my disobedient fingers. The scales would never go away, even when Mrs. Hyacinth left the room. The woman took smoke breaks. She couldn't hide the fact that she had to have one of her Virginia Slims in her long fingers to augment her pursuit of perfectionism in classical music. With the likes of me, of course, she needed to smoke. And in between nicotine hits, I heard her coughing, like the man on the CD. I want to know more. Can what I hear be confirmed? That he's alone at the concert? That for dinner he ate herring and brown bread and drank warm vodka? That like the suit lapel that bears a party pin, his cough has an emblem of its own? I hear death in it. The man can't help himself, not even in the presence of a godlike performer. He must assert his biological terminality, even if it's done at the expense of art, which nearly 50 years later will still reproduce the flaw. Make no mistake, Richter finishes out the sonata with a presto worthy of the blaze of applause that spontaneously erupts from the audience. An unbelievable pianistic display. But still, there is the cough. I strip off the headphones. I feel different. No, damn it, I'm not sleepy. I'm caught up in an inexplicable urge to seek the coughing man or his equivalent. The brush hair stuck in the oil paint, the continuity error in the film, the hairline crack in the statue. Even in the midst of soaring brilliance, the single thing that goes wrong, this fly in the ointment, the mote that gets stuck in the eye and forces it to eventually open wide, seems to lead to what is of most interest. The tenuousness of this breathe in and breathe out that I so naively believe in for myself and those I love. No art, not even my own, can save my father from the final shell burst. Mrs. Hyacinth, unless she threw away her coffin nails and took up jogging and lived to be 100, tells me too. Already she is gone. Tonight I actually give thanks for the coughing man. He is the frail human element that tethers divine-like creations and intentions to earth. Such a one is worth staying awake for and dreaming about in whatever hours remain.
Our first runner-up is Lisa K. Buchanan with All That I Missed. Buchanan's fiction and essays have appeared in Mid-American Review, Natural Bridge, Quick Fiction, and Cosmopolitan, and her honors include awards from Glimmer Train, Carve, and Moment.
All That I Missed by Lisa K. Buchanan. When I first met my future husband, we were both married to other people, he to another woman, I to myself. While he and his ex-wife fought over the car, the cat, and the toothpick holder, I couldn't resist some pride in the fact that my own marital parting was comparatively civilized. Indeed, it was so amicable that my future husband even asked if he could watch, nay, join, my ex and me having sex together. I took only my most personal possessions, leaving behind the rent-controlled flat with hardwood floors, stained glass, commodious bathroom, garden-view balcony, and on-site laundry, all on a tree-lined street in a prized neighborhood. Alimony was not demanded, but as an investment in future peace, I gave myself a week in Florence. My divorce had the appearance of being relatively simple. We had no children, pets, or real estate. No betrayals to avenge, no venom to inject. While my future husband and his former spouse rendered the telephone irrelevant by shouting loudly enough to hear each other across town, myself and I managed a pleasant, almost business-like regard for each other, just as the enlightened divorce books recommend. When over the occasional coffee or glass of wine, her fingers would brush across mine, and we'd broach the topic of our breakup, we were not tragic or condemning, but merely incredulous. Had we truly severed ourselves forever? Was this what we both wanted? After the wedding, my husband's legal battles and triple-digit-per-hour rancor with his former spouse continued. Once when the phone woke me after midnight, I told her it was too late for her to be calling. She, in turn, wanted to know who was I to be answering his line anyway. My husband was inured to her by then, but my former mate caught the import right away, summoned forth my righteous fury, and then managed to diffuse it by pointing out the absurdity of the scene. Lifted from Showdown TV, we decided, so that I can unclamp my jaws and finally fall asleep. Meanwhile, my husband forged a polite wariness with my ex, each of them smugly certain I'd be better off without the other. Jealous? She concluded, when he complained that I was more mocking and sardonic, even cruel under her influence. True, she had an uncanny talent for showing up when the home seas were roughest. But I don't know how I would have survived without her sympathetic smirks, corroborative eye rolls, and foil-wrapped bars of pure dark chocolate. I tried not to admit that our minds had never quite untwined, that I craved her reliable accord and comedic rescue. Nights, when my husband was working downstairs in his studio, she and I tangled legs and whispered in the dark. With her, my woes were justified, my meaning clear. My ex needed no preface or translation, and could comprehend me to a depth that my current spouse could not. One night, shortly after our third anniversary, my husband and I had a fight about the historical Jesus or the evils of corporatism or the way I parked the car in the garage. I hurled his lovingly purchased long-stem roses onto the floor as he slammed the front door behind himself, duffel in hand. By then, I had been talking to my ex almost every night, openly speaking of all that I missed, her lazing around the flat, half-naked and fully absorbed in a lugubrious 19th-century novel, her turning up the R&B and spinning me around the kitchen amid the elaborate preparations of her latest stew-pot wonder, her even temper and undefended lightness, the two of us climbing the tall peak and reaching it as one, raunchy fantasies unencumbered by questions of loyalty or pregnancy. She and I had argued, but, in my memory at least, were never fiercely enraged or deeply wounded by each other. Leaving my first marriage was a mistake, I admitted to the bathroom mirror, when after 2 hours the roses were still on the floor and my husband hadn't returned. My ex poured me a brandy. I gulped and trembled, collapsing in her arms. Could I possibly be forgiven? Would she consider taking me back after all this? If my husband predicted that I would grow tired of myself, he was kind enough not to say so. Indeed, the more I tried to avoid my former love, the more she haunted me. Subway windows, the message machine in my office, framed photos on the hall table. I could not so much as apply lipstick without her insipid kissy mouth puckering at me. Bereft of solitude, I came to understand my first marriage as a clingy, frightened thing, small, proud, and narcissistic. I sought solace one sleepless night in a clear, scalding bath, but even there her troubled face stared up at me. "Have you nothing to do but gaze into my eyes?" I demanded, her disheveled hair and reddened cheeks a mockery of my own. I wept, and yet the tears ran down her face. I turned slightly away. She did the same. I charged her with fawnery, laughing at my every quip, flattering my most egregious pontifications with an obsequious nod. But even then, she replied with a paltry, infuriating echo. I drained the tub, relishing the gravity of her slow retreat, then crawled into bed with my husband. Time would surely separate him from me when our love was most rich, leaving me to myself quite soon enough.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the Missouri Review. To find out more information about the Missouri Review and to see a complete list of the winners of our 2007 audio competition, please visit us at www.missourireview.com.